Northern Maori. Here, you have two offsetting sets of words. Income producing means that he is probably investing for income only, and it would be a breach of duty as far as the remainder person. On the other hand, what does blue chip stocks indicate to you? That it's a safe investment as far as the remainder person. Blue chip stocks tend to grow in value, and on that basis, the later investment, 1 year later, even though it'd be income producing, since it is blue chips, it would be a fair investment by way of allocation between the income beneficiary and the remainder person. And in conclusion, as far as the rights of Bert and Carl against Alex is concerned, on the totality of the $200,000, my conclusion would be that he would be surcharged in the neighborhood of $6,000 to $7,000 for not investing the money. Not investing the money, the second $100,000 for 1 year, but that he should not be surcharged as far as the improper investment in the painting, because it did produce a profit. And this is all predicated on his personal liability. His personal liability for the contract with Dan. Which is most likely the way the court would decide. Arguing there is no trust. The answer they did damn fool if they did. So there is no one to challenge it, so you really don't have to bring it up. As far as top lists are concerned, the decline of statutory lists is tremendous, and modernly I think there's a particular three or four states that have statutory stock list. We went through a period of time after the depression decade in the 40s and early 50s. We went through adoption of stock lists for trustees rather rapidly, and then in the 60s we went through a repeal of stock lists, and they generally do not exist in the United States today. We substituted for the stock list of the recently approved investor rule. Okay, going to the next question, number 10. All parties are contented to unmarried adults. Further provided for the payment in trustees uncontrolled discretion. So we have a discretionary trust, put a number over discretionary, discretion. And it's a discretionary trust of the net income from the trust to trustee's nephew, Norton, free of any claims of Norton's creditors. So we have a spendthrift trust again. But it is not only spendthrift, it is a discretionary spendthrift trust. And for most jurisdictions today recognize also that Norton had no right to anticipate or assign his interest in the trust or any part thereof, which is just part of the spendthrift trust. It's a declaration against assignment for the payment in trustee's uncontrolled discretion, and again the discretionary issue, discretionary trust, of funds from the corpus of the trust of Norton in the event of Norton's need for additional amount. So the first one is discretionary as far as income, and the third parenthesis is discretionary as far as invading the trust grade. I'll circle the word need for a moment, because need is the word need is part of the trust instrument and is a word which may need interpretation as to whether or not the cross is going to be paid. Thomas died and his will was probated. Norton then learned of the trust. Well, the first issue as far as Thomas dying, the expectancy then materializes. I have noted in students writing this answer when I was over a long time ago, I'll go back to the beginning of the problem, and they treated the second paragraph as what I told you to label as an expectancy. They wrote about an equitable interest that became a legal interest at the time of the death of Thomas. And that is incorrect. It is not an equitable interest. There is no interest. It is merely an expectancy. An equitable interest is something that is definite and certain as far as substance is concerned. And you can, no problem, a legal interest will materialize in, or an equitable interest will materialize into a legal interest. But here, an expectancy is all that we have, and it does materialize into reality at the time of the death of Thomas, because the will speaks at the time of death, so it becomes a real interest at the time of the death of Thomas. Now, the fact that Norton then learned of the trust is of no real consequence, because one may, the beneficiary did not learn of the trust at the time that it was created. Norton owned Blackacre, a vacant parcel of land which Anderson wanted. Norton offered to convey Blackacre to Anderson, and Anderson would make the trust irrevocable. Anderson agreed. The big issue here is a ratification of the prior invalid trust, and is done for consideration. Now, the death alone, when Thomas died, and the expectancy materialized, that does not give validity to the trust that Anderson executed. That alone does not give validity to the trust. There must be some subsequent act of ratification, and the buying of Blackacre for $60,000 is the act of ratification, and at the same time, it is modifying the irrevocable trust to make it irrevocable. Anderson agreed, so certainly evidence of this intent that the prior trust instrument be a valid one, and the $100,000 then would become the subject matter as far as the trust is concerned. Okay, the fourth paragraph, the issue is general rule on spendthrift trust. General rule is, this is a spendthrift trust, and the general rule is that they're valid even though there are restraints on alienation of the beneficiary's interest. As a matter of public policy, they are necessary in some circumstances, and the trend is perhaps a greater liberality as far as the spendthrift trust, as long as there is some restriction on the income of the beneficiary that would not tend to defraud a creditor. Now, I didn't say this in the last question because it, although equally applicable, it is probably more applicable here. The problem with the spending, the criticism, right, let's go to the other side of the coin. As far as the spendthrift trust criticism is concerned, and the reason some courts either will not allow it or limit it to support an education, is that it gives an individual the right to hold himself out as a fairly wealthy person. People with whom he does business may believe that he is a wealthy person, but at the same time, he is not. You can incur contracts, incur debts, but there is nothing that can be attached as far as the income beneficiary is concerned. In this case, even we'll come to the discretionary part later, but he is an income beneficiary as far as $100,000 is concerned. Well, if you have $10,000 of extra income, then the holding yourself out as a wealthy person, right, there's no assets to be attached, is the problem the legislature has to deal with. On the other hand, as I said, the public policy tends to support the spendthrift trust because it prevents people from throwing away their money. The parents very often will create spendthrift trust in order to protect the children and see that they're cared for. The public policy is for them, but public policy to some degree is against them at the same time. And you should give the pros and cons, but the trend of the law is to allow them. Right, the fifth paragraph is discretionary trust. Discretionary trusts are also valid. Here, it is discretionary as far as income, also discretionary for the invasion of the trust raised. And giving discretionary power to the trustee, is perfectly permissible, and the only way that you can contest it is to go into court and plead an abuse of discretion. If he fails to give money under the trust instrument, so we have validated the spendthrift aspect of the trust, and we validated the discretionary aspect of the trust. Then we come to the fifth paragraph. You just write that as far as the division of authority is concerned, as to what is going to be protected. And we've been through this once before. Some courts limit protection to income only. To income only. And not the race. Whereas other courts will allow an attachment of the trust race itself. But it depends on the jurisdiction that you're in as to how much protection you're going to get. Now, the general prevailing principle is that the intent of the settlor in creating the trust was to provide income. And on that basis, as long as there is a sort of reasonable income that goes to the beneficiary, that's all that's going to be protected. And under those conditions where there is a continuing reasonable income to the beneficiary, then the court will protect only that and will allow attachment of the race itself. Will allow the attachment of the race itself. Now, one thing the trust problem to note carefully is in the attachment business, as far as the creditor, where you have the settlor and you have the trustee, and we have the race, and we have the spendthrift trust beneficiary down here, and the spendthrift. When we say attach the race, the problem is, as far as D is concerned, it may be income to D for life and then to C, or something such as that. The intent of the settlor is to provide an income to first beneficiary so that he can live without having problems the rest of his life. Now, when we say, as far as a creditor is concerned, in attaching the trust race, he can't get part of that race immediately. He can attach it, and he has to wait until the income period has terminated, and then he can go after the race itself. But he cannot get to the race during the period that the court will uphold the protection of the income. And that logically makes sense as far as the race that generates income and goes to the beneficiary. And although you can attach the race, you can't really get anything out of the race until the trust instrument itself has been performed with respect to the income beneficiary. So generally, you will have an income beneficiary and the remainder person. And there's a problem of how much protection that you're going to get. And in this case, it is not only the matter of protecting, going to the next paragraph, the real issue is interpretation of discretion on the basis of the quote needed unquote discretionary to invade the race when it is quote need. Norton's need for additional amount. Well, as far as the discretionary and even interpreting the word need, since it is entirely discretionary, the only thing that the beneficiary really has is an expectancy. In a discretionary trust, the beneficiary has only an expectancy, and no creditor can reach an expectancy. He can't reach the creditor, in this case, Cross, could not reach until he pays out money. And the trust, the general rule is, that a trustee in a spendthrift discretionary trust is that the trustee cannot be compelled to pay for a claim. He cannot be compelled. Under the word interpretation of need in relation to discretion, the trustee cannot be compelled, the court will not compel him to pay a court claim. So Cross is not going to get paid out of the trust race or income under the discretionary aspect. When then the next paragraph is, since he has in the discretionary issue, he only has an expectancy. The next paragraph is, what happens when the expectancy materializes? When the expectancy materializes, moderately, in the discretionary spendthrift trust, we have a creditor over here. And the trustee is going to pay directly to the beneficiary. There are a number of jurisdictions that want to protect the creditor, and they make the mythical point in time as far as the exercise of discretion is when the trustee decides, when he, quote, decides to pay. Not when he does pay, but the expectancy materializes into a fund of money at the point in time that the trustee decides to pay, not when he pays. Now, chronologically, whether it be 1 moment or 1 hour or 3 days, the trustee must make a decision to pay under his discretion, and then he must pay. If the creditor has attached the fund of money, if he has attached the fund of money in the hands of the trustee, then he is entitled to that fund of money in some jurisdictions on the basis that the point in time that the creditor's right attaches is when the expectancy materializes. And under those conditions, it could be attached in the hands of the trustee. So the creditor could attach before. It's a valid lien on the money that is to be paid out. And the only way you can frustrate the creditor under circumstances such as this, in the discretionary spendthrift trust, the only way the trustee can, once you slap the lien on him, the only way he can frustrate the creditor is what? Not pay anything. But what, in modern practice, what happens? How can you avoid it? This is not part of the problem, but it could easily be, as far as practice and as well as the problem. How can you frustrate the creditor's lien on the trustee and and still put money in the hands of the beneficiary. Well, you cheat. You cheat in plain words. You make loans to him. Or you let him go borrow money and you post the collateral until the creditor, so the statute of limitation runs on the creditor's rights. There are all kinds of problems that come up in actual practice as well as bar problems occasionally in frustrating the creditor as far as lien on the discretionary trust that is to be paid out. Anyway, by way of conclusion, as far as the trust judgment in the majority of jurisdictions today, most jurisdictions today, the trustee may make an income payment to and in the case of beneficiary. And only when it gets in the hands of N, the beneficiary, could it be attached. But this also is frustrated because how does the trustee pay the beneficiary? The beneficiary goes to his office and the trustee rolls off a few $100 bills and the beneficiary puts it in his pocket. How can the creditor get that money? He can't. There is no legal way that he can get that money. When the income beneficiary is paid in cash, there is no way that the creditor can attach that. So if you're not in a jurisdiction which allows the attachment of the money in the hands of the trustee, and in most jurisdictions you cannot do it, then the only way you can get the money as a creditor is to go to the money once it is received by the beneficiary, but this frequently is perverted on the basis of cash payments. So as far as the cost is concerned, is he going to collect? Probably not. He is not going to be able to invade the corpus because it's discretionary. And as far as the income is concerned, the chances of collecting are only in a jurisdiction which allows a lien on the money in the hands of the trustee at the time the trustee makes the decision to pay. Then if he makes that decision, he must pay to the creditor. And there are a few jurisdictions that would allow that. Okay, we have two more. All right, let's take a break then. Because of the nature of the building, it is not practical to use it as a museum declaration includes the settlor, the trustee, the beneficiary, and the trust property is properly described. And then finish the first paragraph by saying the only problem is that the law of the jurisdiction requires a written instrument signed by the trustor, which is not the case here. Now, second paragraph, whenever you create the valid trust, go to the issue of the private or charitable trust and look at the and qualify it as a charitable trust. In this case, it's the County Historical Society. Remember, as far as charitable trust, we have to have a community benefit, and the community benefit has to be for a substantial number of people. So in this case, you should qualify it as a charitable trust and not a private one, because it is to be used as a museum of local history, which will benefit a substantial number of people in the community. So we have a charitable trust. All right. The third paragraph goes to the satisfaction of the statute of fraud. And the first issue of satisfaction, legal issue, is estoppel. Trustee